This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, HB2 is no more. Yesterday, the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill repealing the so-called bathroom legislation. But this was a compromise in a time in which compromises are not looked kindly upon. We go into all the details. A judge refuses to allow a local high school student to graduate before being deported. CMS is still working to come up with a decision on student assignment for next school year. And Luke May from Huntersville nails a spot in the Final Four for North Carolina, setting up a battle between the Carolinas and the Pacific Northwest. How about that? Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Doss Helms is here. She's from the Charlotte Observer, of course. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner, a reporter for WBTV News. I got everything right there. Did you notice?
Surprisingly.
Yeah, surprisingly. Good. Welcome back. And Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Good morning.
Morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. The second and last time we get to use that is our infamous HB2 sounder for news of HB2, which was repealed yesterday. We'll repurpose that because it took a long time to get that done. We had to contact the composer. He's hard to reach these days. 1 week after the first anniversary of the passage of HB2, the bill was repealed yesterday. Rumblings about this started on Monday. It was on, it was off, it was on again. The vote was to come on Wednesday night. Then it did come on Thursday morning and Thursday afternoon in both the Senate and the House and signed yesterday very quickly, almost as quickly as the original bill was signed by Governor McCrory. This was signed by Governor Cooper. And the result is a big compromise. Senate leader Phil Berger.
Compromise sometimes is difficult. And this bill represents a compromise. I don't know that there are that many people that are extremely happy about exactly where we are. There are a lot of folks who would express opinions that we should have done something else, whether they are in favor of the bill or opposed to the bill. However, this is what I believe, and I hope you believe, is good for North Carolina at this time.
And Roy Cooper said something very similar to that.
In a perfect world with a good General Assembly, we would have repealed House Bill 2 fully today and added full statewide protections for LGBT North Carolinians. Unfortunately, our supermajority Republican legislature will not pass these protections.
In a good legislature.
Yeah, you caught that?
Yeah.
With a good legislature, yeah.
Yeah. So, take us through all of this. How did this all come together, since there's obviously unhappiness on all sides?
Without a doubt, there's unhappiness on all sides. And I think the best sign of that is consider this. The NC Values Coalition, which supports HB2, and Equality NC, which is an LGBT organization, who's obviously
on the same side of this.
Obviously opposed to they were both on the same side. Before that, I'm pretty sure those two organizations could only agree on the fact that they have NC, both have NC in their name.
And so, from Charlotte, you have Dan Bishop and Jeff Jackson agreeing on something, which is that this compromise stinks. I don't know how many things they're agreed on, but not a lot.
Yeah, so, you know, and I do have to correct one thing. The deals have been going on since long before this week. This has been sucking the oxygen out of the General Assembly for quite some time. Let's not forget the December special session where we were told there was a repeal deal in the works and the Charlotte City ordinance was removed from the books by the Charlotte City Council. So how this all went down, I think it just boils down to sports. I think the big motivating factor here was the NCAA set yesterday as the deadline for something to be done.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting part. So a lot of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, where there were many Republicans who hated this deal, got up yesterday and said, we're not beholden to the NCAA, and I'm not going to vote to repeal something just because the NCAA said we need to do it by now. So then at his press conference, some reporters asked Governor Cooper, you know, was the NCAA's deadline your motivation? And he said it was a part of it, but it wasn't all of it. But interestingly, he said that he thought that the NCAA deadline was really the motivating factor for Republicans. Republicans mm-hmm. to come to the table and accept a deal, and he's probably correct.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. The other big motivating factor is this. The AP earlier this week put out a report that estimated the economic impact of House Bill 2 was, what, $3.7 billion?
Over 12 years.
Over 12 years. So what was the original response to that from the Republican lawmakers, and more importantly from Dan Forrest, who is the lieutenant governor and the most vocal critic of repealing House Bill 2? And he said, guess what? That works out to 0.5%, one half of 1% of the state's overall GDP. They weren't worried about it.
Well, we lost already this year all the NCAA tournament games. We lost the ACC tournament games. The NBA pulled the All-Star game. All of those were deadlines, previous deadlines, that they ignored. What made this deadline urgent? Because it goes to 2022?
Yes.
Yeah, and this was for real. And not only did you have the NCAA.
The other ones
was,
were for real, too.
No, but this was like, really, guys, this is a big, serious thing. And the other thing is that you have the NCAA was the most public deadline that we had and the most public exertion of pressure upon the leaders in Raleigh on both Republicans and Democrats. But you've also seen the heat turn up from the business community that really came to the table and stepped in and said, you guys need to get this done.
Well, Mac Emmert? Yes, Mac Emmert, who's the president of the NCAA, had this to say after the vote.
There were four distinct problems that the board had with that bill. They've removed some of those now, but not, as you point out, not all of them. And the question that the board will be debating is, if you remove two or three of them, is that enough?
So there's no guarantee that when they get together to vote in the next week about where the next 7 years of games will be, that it will, in fact, rejoin the fold and come back into North Carolina. Is that right, Glenn?
That is correct. I think, and I think that's the ironic part of it. I don't think even the NCAA is thrilled about that. Mm-hmm. Not only are the two parties of mixed opinion, but you know, after all of this, are we going to get the basketball games back?
So what happens if we don't? What happens
if
they pass this bill?
Well, I think we're looking at what we were talking about last week and what they were trying to avoid, which is this becomes a chronic situation for North Carolina. I think the impetus was to say maybe if we can pull off that dreaded label HB2. Mm-hmm. Whatever we throw out there will be okay. People will, you know, we'll get back within the fold of acceptable states. And I think the NCAA will still be sort of that bellwether. And you have a lot of the civil rights groups, whether they're LGBT or the NAACP, still saying this is not acceptable. Yeah. This did not improve things. So we may, in fact, be in that situation where you're talking about economic impact over many, many years.
LGBT community, which we'll talk about in a second, is upset because this does not protect LGBT people in any way. The Values Coalition is upset because it endangers women and children in bathrooms, according to their point of view. And yesterday, State Representative Jeff Collins, a Republican from Nash County, voted no and was upset because of the basketball component.
If we could have props in here, I'd take a basketball covered in money and roll it down the middle aisle there, because that's what this is about, money and basketball. My family's not for sale. My constituents are not for sale.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a sentiment from a lot of Republican lawmakers in the House of Representatives that had like an hour of debate on this. It passed the Senate with virtually no debate.
Yeah, only Dan Bishop was the only one who spoke out against it in the Senate. And Dan Bishop, of course, is
from Charlotte.
Yeah, and the key author.
And the author of HB2.
At least
the
bathroom provisions.
He's right and he's wrong. Of course, if you voted for HB2 and you've backed it, now you decide you want to repeal it, if this is in fact a repeal, then it probably was about basketball and money.
Yeah.
But there's another side where it's not about basketball and money at all. It's about civil rights and human rights. So I think he's right and he's wrong.
Gets really complicated. What does this bill do or not do?
Well, there are four sections in this bill. And it's funny because when you watch legislation, it's, you know, this is House Bill 142, a bill that was already passed by the House. And that becomes important in how quickly they turn this around. So the bill was originally about boards that oversee occupations. So it was originally about things like who can be a massage therapist, who can, you know, do taxes, those kinds of board certification things. So they strip that out. And they insert this very brief bill. I think it's like 157 words.
It's one page. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Section 1, in kind of cloaked language because they use the official session law numbers, repeals House Bill 2. So it does repeal House Bill 2. And there are tricks with that too. Section 2 bars any state agency or subdivision of the state, so that's school boards and schools and universities and cities and counties and all of that, from setting any access rules on who can or who cannot use public bathrooms and locker rooms and showers and the usual stuff we talk about with HB2. Then comes Section 3. In Section 3, I remember reading this thinking, wow, this is really broadly written. Section 3 stops municipalities, cities and towns and counties from passing any new ordinances or rules on private employment and public accommodations. And then Section 4 says, all right, that provision will stay in place until December 1st of 2020. Now, first of all, when you talk about no new rules at all for anything dealing with public accommodation or private employment, stop and think that that is a major part of what cities, towns, and counties actually do. And the wording is so broad that it would stop them from doing that.
Was that intentional, do you think, or was it because this was rushed through so quickly they didn't really vet it?
I think there's a third version of this. I think it's one of those classic groupthink moments where all of this group of men sat together trying to negotiate something out so quickly that there became a level of second reference. They assumed that this was really to stop cities like Charlotte from passing a similar non-discrimination ordinance protections as they have in the past. The bathroom stuff, that was already dealt with in the first section. So I think they all just assumed that's what this was about. But words matter in legislation.
Yes.
A lot. And that is – I can't wait. I think that is where the unintended consequences are going to come from.
This was known – HB2 was known around the country as North Carolina's bathroom bill for obvious reasons. But there was so much more in HB2 that was really the problem, not just the bathrooms. Yet Democratic leader Darren Jackson of Knightdale said yesterday the result of the repeal is that transgender men and women can use the restrooms of their choice without fear of being prosecuted. So for those concerned with the bathroom portion of HB2, should they continue to be concerned, or does that
no? I don't think so. Sorry, if you had more questions.
No,
no, and what it effectively does, and what you heard from Republicans and Democrats who supported the repeal yesterday, was that this sets it back to before HB2, to before the Charlotte City Council. Depending on which party you are, it's either before HB2 or before the Charlotte, that evil Charlotte City Council ordinance, and that essentially people aren't going to be in the bathroom asking, not that they were under HB2, but, you know, there wasn't.
Or
there,
even before HB2.
Yeah, there weren't any prosecutions under HB2, were
that,
there?
That's correct. And there was no clause allowing that, actually. But, you know, bottom line is this resets it unless you're doing something that you shouldn't be anyways in a bathroom. No one will know or no one will care under the law. And that's what a lot of people said was important to do. But I think it's also important when we talk about repealing House Bill 2 to remember that House Bill 2 included a lot of other non-bathroom provisions that were problematic on a lot of different ways to a lot of different people. And so to the extent that this bill has repealed all of that and reset some of the things related to the bathroom provision, I think is people would say is progress. And certainly Darren Jackson, the Democrat leader, said that that was a progress.
I talked to Willie Ratchford this week at the – is it the Community Relations Committee?
Yep.
And he pointed out something that I didn't realize, that under HB2, their responsibility to enforce public – accommodations ordinances had effectively been stripped from him. They still had other things, but they were no longer responsible for doing that.
More to talk about with regard to the repeal yesterday of HB2, and we'll get to it, and we'll hear from other players who are not happy about anything that happened yesterday when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Core 365, directly serving Charlotte organizations since 2008 and offering comprehensive information solutions, including document scanning and shredding. Detailed information at cor365.com. And Bojangles, featuring five combo meals all day, every day. Bojangles, chicken and biscuits, serving the Carolinas since 1977. What does it mean to be human? That's the question that Public Radio's Krista Tippett has been trying to find the answer to. That and some other big questions as well. She conducts that research, or her search for these answers, on her program On Being, and because we live in a divided nation, she's launched the Civil Conversations Project to help the country talk through its differences. Next stop, Charlotte. and we'll have our own civil conversation with Krista Tippett from the Duke Energy Theater here at Spirit Square on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Senate's own Russia probe, Trump and Kohl, sanctuary cities on notice, Brexit gets real. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The weekly news roundup continues on Point from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talk's Friday news roundup. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Ann Dawes Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. We're talking about yesterday's repeal of HB 2, a week after the one-year anniversary of its passage. One of the things that this repeal bill, this legislation that was signed yesterday by the Cooper, contains, and we've already talked a little bit about this, is a moratorium of 3 years now, yep, by my count, up till 2020, for municipalities around the state to be able to pass anything like the ordinance that led to the passage of HB 2. Previous repeal attempts contained moratoria of
months.
Mm-hmm. And nobody was going to, the Democrats were not willing to make that happen.
No, that's not true. The governor asked Democrats to vote against it.
Well, the governor wasn't happy with it.
That's true.
This is 3 years, and yes, the governor said, do it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, too. Part of this, I'm sure, comes down to negotiations, because to be fair, those moratoria were also, they also were tied to referenda in most of the cases, where, you know, if a passage of a bill, you know, an ordinance, people could, with some of the bills, then call for, you know, petition to have a public referendum on the bill. I know that they're not all of them.
Well, but not the specific December, because I think it's important. No, let's compare to the December deal that was – could have passed in December, right, 4 days before Christmas, that Roy Cooper, then Governor-elect Roy Cooper, specifically called in to the Senate Democrat caucus and said, oppose this bill. And we heard a majority of the Senate Democrats, and Phil Berger had enough Republicans cobbled together that bill would have cleared the Senate and then it would have jammed it through the House in December. And we know over the last couple of weeks that there's been a lot of remorse on the part of Democrats. Boy, we should have taken that deal. But interestingly, Governor Cooper was asked that in his press conference yesterday afternoon. Hey, you know, don't you feel stupid? I'm paraphrasing. And he said, look, in December, the agreement that I had with Republicans was that the Charlotte Council would repeal their ordinance and they'd have a straight repeal. That was not the deal that we had in December, and this is the deal we had today. So now we're going to take it. Mm.
And getting back to basketball, the NCAA is still leaving a great big question mark on whether or not they will say yes to North Carolina in the future when they get together to decide where the next 7 years of playoff games will be played. Yesterday, ACC Commissioner John Swofford, and we have to remember that the ACC is headquartered in Greensboro, said, the recently passed legislation allows the opportunity to reopen the discussion with the ACC Council of Presidents regarding neutral site conference championships being held in the state of North Carolina. This discussion will take place in the near future, and following any decisions by the ACC Council of Presidents, announcements will be forthcoming. I don't know why, but to me that sounds like it's done. They're coming back.
I would say it's not a fait accompli, but that's exactly where they want to go. And I think the reason I at least consider this not to be a done deal, as you said, is because you're still waiting to hear from the NCAA.
Will they follow the lead of the NCAA?
Yeah, I absolutely believe so. They don't want to I don't think the ACC wants to be the league that comes forward too quickly. I think everybody really wants to make sure that this is indeed palatable given their past stances.
But we know that the governor's office, that Republican leaders in the legislature have been on the phone with the ACC and with the NCAA and with others all throughout this process. And, you know, they believe that they have the tacit endorsement of these groups.
But one of the biggest things that the ACC has in its back pocket is a pile of cash from playing the men's basketball tournament in Brooklyn. So, quite seriously, I think you know, they may have tacit agreements. There are certainly phone calls. But, you know, when you're a league that has the ability to make more money playing in other places, that matters.
Not come back to North Carolina, but if it stays in Brooklyn, it's not because of HB2. It's because they want to make more money in Brooklyn.
Glenn.
I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that the NCAA will come back. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to oppose a bill that got bipartisan support, even a bill that leaves
everyone
unhappy.
Well, that begs the question, why did they pull out in the first place? Why did the NBA, why did the ACC, why did the NCAA pull out in the first place? Was it over the bathroom portions?
Because HB2 was a really bad bill.
Was it because of the bathroom portions, or was it because of the discrimination portions?
Well, the broader LGBT issues are what were always cited, and we haven't really moved ahead on that. Arguably, we've moved backward on that.
In fact, according to the LGBT community, we've moved backward. Because they were really disappointed by this. They were incensed by this and by the details, and because there were no representatives from the LGBT community at the table. Here's Chad Griffin, president of the Human Rights Campaign.
When you were dealing with the rights, the fundamental rights and protections of a minority community, there is no deal that they aren't part of. Ask Speaker Moore. Ask Senate President Berger. And any Democrat or Republican that's been in the rooms orchestrating these deals, what trans person is at the table? What LGBT person is at the table? You have no deal without us at the table and without us agreeing that a deal is a deal. It does not repeal HB2. It is simply a new version of HB2 that abandons LGBTQ people, targets the transgender community again and especially, and leaves thousands of North Carolinians vulnerable to discrimination at work, at home, and in their communities.
So if the NCAA and the NBA and others pulled games, if the business community decided not to relocate over here because of the discriminatory aspects of HB2 with regard to LGBTQ rights, does this new bill help?
I believe it does, and I believe that's what they think it. I believe that's what all the parties who sucked it up and told their people to vote for this repeal yesterday legitimately and genuinely believe that.
But if you got Chris Scrow, head of Equality NC, calling this a doubling down on discrimination against the LGBT community, and you've got Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts, who's up for re-election and seeking the governor's endorsement, coming down against the governor on this bill, saying this is a rejection of Charlotte's and North Carolina's progressive, inclusive values. What does that tell the business community? What does it tell the sports leagues?
It says politics is still at play here. I mean, that's really what this boils down to. Look, with Jennifer Roberts, and she sent that out, as you said, in a tweet, I think it's important to note that her two declared primary rivals. Democratic State Senator Jill Ford.
Who voted yes yesterday.
And Vi Lyles, who I believe is, you know, kind of supporting it. I don't think she's made a clear, 100% crystal clear
stance.
Jill
Ford voted for it.
Voted for it. I think this is a way that Jennifer Roberts can differentiate herself with a very important and influential Democratic voter base that frankly was not too pleased with what she did back in December, which was championing the removal of the city ordinance in question. So, you know, businesses are very savvy. They're going to decide whether or not this really accomplishes what they want. And I'm not sure exactly what they're going to do, but North Carolina is a place that they would rather be here to do business in than not. So they could see this as an opening. Sports leagues, they deal with public perception in a slightly different way.
I think it was Tim Moore I heard on the radio on WFAE this morning saying that I'm going to forget now.
He didn't take his ginkgo.
I didn't.
but look, here's the important in the background behind the discussions over how or if to repeal House Bill 2 that's been going on. I spoke with Ned Curran yesterday, Charlotte businessman, chairman of the Charlotte Chamber, who turns out was basically the business guy brokering the deal between Democrats and Republicans. But he didn't tell me this exact thing. But in the background of these talks, essentially, has been the business community saying, look, we've just got to get HB2 off the books.
Yep.
And the LGBT community and people like Chris Scrow saying, we will only take a clean repeal. And the business community saying, well, that's not going to happen. So let's find a solution that can work for everybody. And so I really think this is the business community will get behind this.
Does this take us back to pre-HB2 conditions in North Carolina?
It matters on your how you want to look at it, partially. But you could also argue that it locks us into pre-HB2 conditions because of that moratorium.
Right.
Good way to put it.
Yeah. So, you know, the better question is not where it takes us, because that's clear. The better question is that where we want to be as a city, as a state, terms of public perception?
Democratic leader Dan Blue, who is from the Raleigh area, said yesterday in voting for the bill and encouraging others to vote for the bill that the bill resets the conversation about new definitions of discrimination. What does that mean?
I think it means that they rushed this the first time, and they want a do-over. They want a mulligan.
Yeah, and I don't think it is up for interpretation as to whether this sets us back to pre-HB2, because pre-HB2, Charlotte could and did pass its own ordinance, and that, at least for the next 3.5 years, is not an option. So I don't think it is a complete reset even. It's a new set.
For Democrats and for the governor, who are largely supported by the LGBT community, what is the political consequence of this?
I think for the LGBT community, it creates an interesting situation because several of the groups have said there will be consequences for this for Democrats. And it's sort of hard to imagine that they will then shift to Republicans, who are viewed as even more problematic. So I don't know if there are going to be a lot of efforts to unseat incumbents who supported this in primaries.
Well, will there be – I'm sorry, Glenn.
No, go ahead. Well, on the other hand, I think you're right, Ann. I think they're locked in. They're not going to go to the Republican Party, and any hope of moving their agenda forward is going to rest with the Democrats. So,
primary challenge, anyone?
I think it puts them in a very tenuous position. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it comes. I think it comes in the form of primary challenge. Glenn is absolutely right.
Well, what about primary challenge for Republicans? I mean, the Republicans aren't – there are a lot of Republicans who are not happy with this either.
Yes. Absolutely right. I mean, you know, this is indeed the new power dynamic when it comes to what has turned into a dirty word in politics, compromise.
The new
power dynamic is everybody is so siloed that you don't try to find a more moderate or slightly less moderate candidate from either party if you disagree with what your elected official did. You go farther to the polls.
So for the LGBT community, this was about discrimination. But the other side, it was about bathroom privacy and safety. And here's what Tammy Fitzgerald, executive director of the North Carolina Values Coalition, had to say after yesterday's vote.
We thought that HB2 was a great law. It was a perfect protection for the people's privacy and safety in bathrooms. These chambers today were filled with men and women who've been bullied, and there's been a full court press by the NCAA and the business community for months, you know, to repeal this law. But the truth remains that no basketball game, corporation, or entertainment event is worth even one little girl losing her privacy and dignity to a boy in the locker room.
Go ahead, Tom.
I do think that is – I know that is Ms. Fitzgerald's personally, you know, deeply held conviction. But I do think it is important to note two things on this. Again, number one, no prosecutions or even charges during HB2 for any kind of bathroom violation. And number two, statistics do not show that there was any increased threat before, during, or after House Bill 2 – because of transgender bathroom use.
Right.
And can I add a three there? Is that as some Republican lawmakers in the House pointed out yesterday during the debate, there are a number of laws already on the books in North Carolina that are designed to keep people from doing what they're not supposed to in bathrooms anyways. If some man is in the changing room with a little girl, he shouldn't be there, and that's already illegal before and after House Bill 2.
Well, it's a red herring that's been used by the right very successfully because they have other pieces of their platform that they would like to see or not see happen. But some reason that aspect of it sticks.
Well, it's visual. It's very easy for people to imagine. I do quibble a bit with your distinction of using this as a red herring. For some, I do, you know, that certainly some groups are using it as such, but other people,
believe it.
Yeah. And we can agree or disagree on it, but I do think we have to acknowledge that it's believed.
It essentially comes down to people's ability to object to somebody who doesn't look right to them, because that's the bottom line, is that you don't know who's has what biology, but if somebody doesn't look feminine enough or masculine enough and you choose to go to security, that's that extremely rare circumstance. And what happens then?
She used the word bully And she was referring to bullying of the legislature and lawmakers by companies and sports leagues. But isn't that the reason for the original Charlotte Ordinance, to protect transgendered children and others from being bullied?
I don't know about that. I honestly don't. I think that was a point that was brought up afterwards, and that we can talk about that point if you like. But I believe that this was broader. I mean, depending on your political point of view, the Charlotte City Council surely, I mean, they believe this was a minority rights issue. Bullying seems to become, you know, something that they all talked about afterwards.
Was the legislature, was the government, was North Carolina bullied by sports and business
interests? If you define bullying as strong lobbying for a case, then perhaps yes. But I think bullying is almost by definition somebody that has power against somebody that is weaker.
Yeah.
And so when you do have a majority bullying a transgender child, right, you know, that seems like a logical definition of bullying, whereas lobbying at the state level among many powerful entities,
business,
I think that's a stretch of the
done.
Term. Yeah.
I don't have a problem with the term bullying, but I think bullying applies to just about everything involved in this, including HB2. HB2 was bullying. It was the Republican legislators' way of bullying the Charlotte City Council and other cities that might want to pass non-discrimination ordinances.
Well, Governor Cooper, prior to the vote, said he was happy with the compromise and that passing this would be help to begin to repair our reputation. But if the LGBT community is not happy with this because of the lack of protections, why would anybody be happy with this? Why would this repair our reputation for those who felt our reputation was damaged in the first place?
Because there are a lot of people. If you read the headlines, it's simple. What's the headline right now?
Repealed.
North Carolina repealed its bathroom bill.
And most North Carolinians do not belong to the LGBT community. And there are a lot of people who may not necessarily understand HB2, but they know that they're tired of hearing about it and that they are tired of seeing consequences. And so they just want to repeal. And I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm just saying if that's the calculation you have to take.
I think it's going to boil down to how well they're able to get their message out and how well their PR machine is. If they're able to make this an issue, then it may not go away. If you look at this through the lens of, say, the civil rights movement, there was a time that separate but equal was okay, but the civil rights leaders were able to implement a campaign against that.
And then there's the question of whether or not we are really done with this. Listen to what Mecklenburg County Senator Jeff Tart said in the course of telling people why he decided to vote for this bill.
I don't think it's the end game by any stretch. Would be my guess that this is the ultimate perfect answer, that everybody goes away and everybody says, "Oh, this is it, perfect. Never have to tweak it again." I think we've got something that hopefully the businesses are comfortable with. They recognize we don't have any ordinance or statutes in place that would have a perception of enabling discrimination. But I think people are going to also step back candidly and say, "Yeah, this isn't quite as far as we need to go." And there'll need to be more work over time.
So we may have ongoing discussions about this?
Well, that's what Jeff Tart told me, but I got to tell you, I think the appetite for this legislatively is basically satiated. I don't think anybody's going to start tweaking this unless there's a major problem, because they just don't want to open this Pandora's box again.
Well, believe it or not, as we always say, there were other stories in the news.
No.
Yes, and we will go into many of them as we can in the next few minutes when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business now offering hybrid MBA courses, meeting online and in person at the university's Center City campus. The Russia investigation ratchets up with the Senate hearing. President Trump Trump unwinds Obama's climate policies with an eye on helping the coal industry. The White House puts so-called sanctuary cities on notice. And Britain's divorce from the European Union moves forward. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about in the national and international news roundup coming up on Point with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our look at what's going on here in Charlotte and North Carolina in just a moment. Stay with us.
Whether the day's news is happening in your backyard or across the globe, you depend on NPR News to bring you the latest.
Kuala Lumpur International Airport, something caused his sudden death.
The two front runners in the French presidential race were both pro-Russian.
Japan's prime minister called the missile launch absolutely intolerable.
For news of the new administration's first 100 days and more, listen every day.
Stay in touch on air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, KeyCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Before we move on, we have one question from a listener about HB2. What happens to the lawsuits that have been created over
HB2? They stay, and that's why they said the public reason they gave for the moratorium extending to 2020 is to give the lawsuits a time to work their way through the court. I do believe a lot of people are hoping at some point, the court system will just clear all this issue up.
Okay, moving on. Gus Zamudio, the Northwest School of the Arts student who was here without documentation, arrested and detained in Georgia. He had been charged with embezzlement, which was pleaded down to a misdemeanor, and the money, as I understand, which was taken from Harris Teeter, was repaid by friends and family. It was hoped that he would be able to graduate from Northwest before being deported, but the judge said no, and the judge also decided not to order deportation per se. Instead, he has told Gus to self-deport, voluntarily leave the country. Tom, what's the difference?
Basically the difference in terms of self-deportation versus deportation at first blush is who picks up the bill for the airline flight. But there's another reason too. If you self-deport under a misdemeanor, you have a better chance, a potential chance at least, of legally re-entering the country at a future point.
So when he lands in Mexico, mm-hmm. he could go and apply for a visa to come back?
In theory, yeah. I mean, that is the process that he can go through. I don't know if there is a waiting period or not. I can't recall that right off the top of my head. But self-deportation instead of forced deportation does allow you the option of legally re-entering the country.
So and his lawyer has noted that there's another big difference, which is they buy a plane ticket and his family is there to meet him in Mexico City at the airport, as opposed to the way his lawyer phrased it was being dumped at the border where he would potentially be at risk for a whole lot of things.
Well, he, I think, came here when he was five.
Yes.
Do we know if he's been back to Mexico? Do we know if he has family on the other side of the border? So that when the
his
plane
lawyer says he has family. I mean, I don't think it's the family, obviously, that he has lived with and grown up with.
So is CMS liable to give him a degree anyway, or are they liable just to
I don't
say,
think you can you give an honorary high school diploma. I think he would have to in some way earn it. That's not something you can
could,
just could award as a farewell
gift.
Could
he take his GED from Mexico and get an American high school degree?
No. I mean, you've got to realize these are two separate countries, and the education systems are very different. There is no NAFTA provision in terms of diplomas. You can't do it back and forth.
CMS has still not released any information, Anne, on the new student assignment plan, which would roll out next year. What's taking so long, and when do you expect they might release that information?
Oh, they actually have released a lot of information, just not the information that people want, which
right.
is what's actually going to happen to my schools. And what they did this week was rolled out a really complicated mathematical formula. They have identified four things that they're looking at as really important factors. One is socioeconomic diversity or isolation. Diversity is good. Isolation is bad. One is crowding or potentially underfilled buildings. One is whether students are indeed close to home. And the other one is whether you have schools that the feeder patterns are broken up. A middle school, say, where kids go off to three different high schools, that's considered not good. So they crunched this all into a formula that they say they're going to use to rank all 138 schools that have zones. And it's kind of like taking the steak and broccoli and red wine and chocolate cake that make a really nice meal and throwing them into a blender and serving it up. And that was kind of the reaction that a lot of school board members had was, what is this and what do we do with this? Some big questions raised about that ranking system. One of them is, So whatever comes out as number one on this list, which will be a weird conglomeration of those factors, and so that's the top priority for change. What does that then mean for the ripple effect? What if the schools surrounding number one are right. way down on the list? So how do we do that? The other big question is, what does this really do about breaking up the high concentrations of poverty, which was identified as a driving factor in this? Because under this rating system, it is an equally high priority to change Providence Spring Elementary, which is 99.78% high SES, versus Devonshire Elementary, which is 99.84% low SES. And I think as a common sense matter, there is an argument that extreme concentrations of wealth are not good either, but it's just not the same level of urgency. So you had some school board members saying, we have been talking for 2 years about doing something to desegregate these intensely concentrated poverty, non-white schools, and in reality, we're not sure that we're going to get there.
And the clock is ticking both on the school year, because this would go into effect next fall, I guess. But it's also ticking
a year from this fall.
Well, even so, because this is high season for selling houses,
yes.
And this impacts property values and real estate values.
It does, and we kind of saw that play out on Nextdoor.com, which is a message bulletin board for neighborhoods, and especially in the south suburbs. Those choice schools are a big part of property values. So we had an anonymous but authoritative-looking letter that was being circulated, put in people's boxes hand-to-hand, saying that they are going to move some of these neighborhoods from the Providence High School zone to the Butler High School zone, which is viewed as less desirable. And we actually had a person on there who said, I had an offer on my house, and that prospective buyer went and asked around and heard that we were going to turn into Butler zone and withdrew the offer. So people are really, really anxious, no matter how much CMS says, we're not doing fruit basket jumble, we're not sending, you know, we're not going to take Providence and Devonshire and bus kids 15 miles to mix those up. It doesn't matter. If your neighborhood moves to a school that is viewed as slightly less desirable, yeah. That's a big deal.
Yesterday on this program, we had Ophelia Garman-Brown and Dee Odell, the two co-chairs of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Opportunity Task Force, to talk about their report, which was released this week, which made 100 recommendations for changing Charlotte's status as 50th out of 50 cities for upward economic mobility. That report met with some criticism from media outlets. Because there was no silver bullet. There was no aha moment, and there's no big solution here. Was that criticism fair, Glenn?
Was it fair? I think it was accurate. I don't know if it was fair. There was no silver bullet. And I think those who thought there would be a silver bullet were probably misguided. Mm-hmm. I think the task force went about as far as it could in certain areas, and in fact, in some areas, I think they may have actually exceeded expectations. Basically, they focused on three areas: early childhood education, early child care and education, college and career readiness, and the fourth one,
child and family stability was
child and family stability, exactly. And in that one, I think they actually took a very bold approach to even broach that topic. That's a very sensitive topic for the African-American community. And so I think they were very bold to even go down that road to talk about that.
And that deals with affordable housing. It deals with two parents. It deals with income stability and minimum wage. This is all interconnected. What you just talked about with the schools and the high pockets of poverty that they're trying to break up, this is all interconnected. And Dee Odell sat here yesterday and said, this is something that even if we have the political fortitude and the community has the fortitude to see this through, this will take decades. This is not going to happen overnight. Is there an appetite among people who are not really affected by this to change this, to make it work, to make it work for them?
Well, I'm probably not the one to ask that question to. I think there are probably enough people with an appetite to affect change. But I think the other part of that is, at the end of the day, it can't end with this report. The African-American community has to get involved in this, and we have to be a part of the solution. One of my criticisms of the task force from the very beginning was that it did not include the people that it was trying to help. if you want to help people who are in these positions, they need to be a part of the solution.
Were they not part of the listening conversation?
Well, they were part of the listening, but that's different. It's very different.
They should have been on the task force.
I absolutely believe they should have been on the
task force. Well, James Ford is heading up the next task force because this work is being handed off to an implementation task force, and he's the former teacher of the year. He's been on this program. He's a remarkable individual who's selected to lead the next steps in this effort, but he's already the center of a controversy over a social media post that he made that some interpreted as equating Donald Trump voters with white supremacists. He was responding to a tweet from the Roanoke Times, which pointed out that Appalachia voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, but now bear the brunt of his budget cuts. And Ford tweeted back, "There may yet be redemption for them and an opportunity to join the struggle, but they must disavow white supremacy. That ideology keeps them stuck." And as people began to attack him, he said, "Look, I have a record of addressing racial problems, segregation, and social equity issues head on." And in his job with the Opportunity Task Force, he's already called for frank discussions on race. Is that tweet the beginning of these discussions?
I think it is, and I think it's you could view that tweet battle as just some politicians sniping at somebody with a different point of view. I think the way that he talks about white supremacy actually is really important going forward and is going to be a friction point, because some people want to talk about, if you're white and you want to talk about race, you want to talk about it as being them. What are we going to do to, for, or with them? And if we acknowledge that whiteness is a part of this discussion, white supremacists are those bad guys over there with the hoods. And when James Ford talks about this, and I have spent a good deal of time talking with him, have seen his presentation, it is about white supremacy and institutionalized racism being a pervasive part of our society and something that everybody around this table is affected by, even though we would not call ourselves white supremacists at all.
Is white supremacy the same as white privilege?
I think it is similar, except it is a mindset that becomes pervasive that maybe we really are just a little bit more capable and bright and hardworking.
I do want to bring up one thing, though. If you want to have a frank discussion about race, and I do think that that is a discussion that is in such dire need of happening, you can't start that discussion by just overwhelmingly characterizing the other side as being disgusting. And that's what white supremacy is. It's tough. But you have to not – you can't just ball everybody up into a specific category that is inherently awful. It's not a fair way to start a discussion. I understand that white supremacy is out there. I understand his point. But, you know, my wife is from Appalachia. I actually spent a decent amount of time there. I think categorizing everybody as white supremacists there is no more accurate than categorizing, you know, African Americans who happen to live as the inner city as all the kinds of things that white supremacists would categorize them as. It's not a helpful start.
I don't think he necessarily categorized everyone who lives in Appalachia as racist as much as the Trump supporters who live in Appalachia or wherever. But I guess my bigger point is, I think you would have a hard time finding very many African Americans who don't harbor some of those thoughts that race played a huge part in the election of Donald Trump. So he's not saying anything that is not pervasive in the African American community.
Take our country back, to many people, is code word. For
absolutely. Absolutely.
Make America great again is a code phrase.
Absolutely. And so who are you going to find who harbors none of those thoughts in the African American community? We've been on the receiving end of racism in this country for over 400 years. I think we know what it looked like, what it looks like. I think you're right, Tom. I think it's always dangerous to paint with a very broad brush. But if we're going to have an honest discussion about race in this country, which I think we've probably talked to death, I think the time's over for talking and more action, I think we have to be able to speak honestly with one another about our thoughts and our feelings.
And I agree 100% with that. My problem with this is, in order to have that frank discussion, which again is sorely needed, I don't think you can start. It's not an invitation to the table. That's my point.
But there's also a phrase that you hear a lot in discussions, people who are trying to broach discussions of race, white fragility, the idea that we as white people are so defensive and so,
that's a fair point,
so alarmed by anything that might make us look bad, yeah, that we can't listen until we've been assured that we are personally wonderful. And I think from that context, having James Ford not even get a chance to step up to the mic, but somebody looking up and people saying, we need apologies, we need retractions, might be viewed as a demonstration of that.
Well, let's
talking about a man who hasn't apologized for anything, but talking about a president who's yet to apologize.
And officially, though, he's not talking about the president. He's talking about the people who voted for him.
Fair enough.
Okay. So let's talk about something that brings everybody in North Carolina together, and that is basketball, where a mere mortal from Huntersville made the magic shot against Kentucky, allowing UNC to squeak into the Final Four. That mere mortal is Luke May, and here is CBS TV's Jim Nance describing the moment.
With five, looks up, driving in, May for the win! North Carolina! With 0.3 seconds to go! An incredible shot!
And that is why people love college basketball, and that shot set up an East-West battle this weekend, specifically a Carolina versus the Pacific Northwest. Have North and South Carolina ever played in the same Final Four?
South Carolina's never played in the Final Four, so that's an easy answer.
Okay. And UNC will play Oregon, and USC will play Gonzaga there in Seattle. What do we know about what the bookies are saying?
That they like your money.
Nobody at this table knows anything about sports.
No. We know about sports gambling, though. I don't know. Yeah.
I just learned about Luke May and his eyebrows this week, so I'm totally out of it.
I'm just asking you what the odds are. Who's saying who's going to win?
I've been too busy tracking the odds of HB2 being repealed.
I will say this. This year's March Madness was proclaimed early on as being absolutely crazy. That there was really no way just to absolutely peg down who was the clear favorite. That has played out so far. So Oregon was not supposed to be here. So USC was not even supposed to know what the Final Four means.
Is it conceivable that this will be on the Monday night game, the final game?
Could be.
Carolina blowout?
Yes, and it'll all be on CBS.
Right. Thank you. On WBTV. Even on AT&T.
Shameless plug.
But once again, South Carolina will be on the wrong side of the divide. Tom Bullock from WFAE, Glenn Perkins from Chief City Metro, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner from WBTV, CBS, where the NCAA.